and a very good morning to you. We're live in London and you're with Monocle on Sunday with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up, I'm joined in the studio by Nina Dos Santos and David Badanis, bringing their views to the big stories of the week. Nina, good morning. What have you spotted?
Good morning. Well, I'm particularly interested in this sort of show of force by Brigitte and Emmanuel Macron. On the one hand, he's sort of having these pictures taken of him looking decidedly macho in the boxing ring, while she's talking about why she hasn't retired her miniskirts aged 70, because she says that makes her the epitome of French female fashion.
We will be heading to Paris for the latest news from France and North Africa.
Hello, this is Monocle correspondent Mary Fitzgerald with the news and views from around the Mediterranean today.
And we'll be joined by Monocle's correspondent in Vienna for the latest from the region as Slovakia heads to the polls. It's the 24th of March, 2024. Live from London, this is Monocle on Sunday.
Live from London, this is Monocle on Sunday with Emma Nelson.
And a very good morning to you from a bright but chilly London. Bright insofar as for the first time we've seen the yellow ball in the sky is back, ladies and gentlemen. It's great.
Is it?
I didn't
notice it 10 minutes ago.
Okay.
Maybe it's quickly, you know, made an appearance and filed itself away for the next couple of weeks.
It winked at me this morning on the way in, and then it's obviously decided to sort of, it's too shy. How are you, David Badanis? Are you well? What's been happening in the Badanis world this week?
Badanis has been excited to realize this is the 50th anniversary of Stephen King's book, Carrie. He was a teacher living in a trailer in Maine, really very bored out of his mind, carrying his crying children up and down in the tiny trailer on his shoulder. And he noticed how mean some of the girls in the secondary school were. And he started this manuscript. And it was first sent to New York agents. Nobody was interested, but they found out that the secretary said, this is great. And they were duplicating it and copying it and passing it among each other. And finally, one editor actually appropriately read it. And it was the breakthrough to his career.
And what was it that made you, I mean, it is one of the most horrible films you'll ever see, one of the most brilliant films you'll ever see.
Correct. And the supernatural is only a little bit. It's about a teenage girl who doesn't fit. And she doesn't fit, which has been described a lot in literature. But what he does is he sympathetically, or at least with reality, enters the mind of the women who are persecuting her. And you see how they themselves are sort of conflicted and unsure. But if they can find the scapegoat, life is better.
It's a pretty big jump that you have to make if you're Stephen King, from living in a trailer carrying your kids around to writing one of the most disturbing pieces of modern literature that you can possibly have. I mean, one wonders what's been going on in his head to make him make that, just to go so dark so quickly.
Well, 50 years later, it rings a chord with today's modern era. I mean, we've just come out of a week when, you know, for the last 2 months, the world has been awash with feverish speculation about the whereabouts and well-being of the Princess of Wales. And now we know that there's a really, you know, tragic reason for her absence. But the conspiracies and all the kind of cyberbullying today are very much what this book talks about 50 years ago, this sort of psychological torment that for some reason groups of people, and in particular women, can focus on other women, whether it's online or whether it's in person.
I think that's the fundamental point. Women are often placed in a position where everybody has a right to comment on it. Oh, you're losing weight, or oh, you're pregnant, or oh, you're drinking while you're pregnant, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Men clearly have a certain amount of grief, heart attacks, being hit by high-velocity bullets from snipers in wartime. But women are placed in public and judged. Think of a male spouse versus a female spouse in high political office.
And let's just do straight that away. Straight away, I mean, let's talk about Emmanuel Macron and Brigitte Macron. They've been making the headlines for different reasons this week, but the similar theme is of public perception. Now, Emmanuel Macron was subject to some quite marvellous photographs this week.
Studied, weren't they?
Oh, so studied. By his official photographer, who I am a super fan of, and I would urge everybody to go and have a look at the photographs that she does, because they are so, so good. But they are of him boxing. And, I mean, this is a man in his, what, early to mid-40s. This is a man who's obviously trying to... Well, I don't know what kind of image was he trying to persuade, project by this. I mean, Nina, would you be kind enough to sort of describe these images for us?
So it's a bit like sort of the Minotaur, isn't it? Trying to escape, you know, from the labyrinth. He's there boxing, you know, hitting the boxing, was it the punch bag, with, you know, his bicep in full force and sort of grimacing as he does it. It is the ultimate sort of show of macho power. And of course, it comes about a week and a half after he, you know, flexed his political muscles over the subject of whether or not Western troops, in particular NATO, should send forces, albeit in a support a capacity, across the Rubicon, across NATO's borders into Ukraine. And this has stimulated much sort of political debate. It's France, you know, is the big, you know, with a big nuclear deterrent, the big nuclear and defence power inside the EU and this part of the world. You know, he's flexing his political muscle to move the dial. And now he's doing it at home as well. All of this is happening for a couple of domestic reasons, as far as I can see. One, obviously, the European elections are coming up for the European Parliament, and his centrist party is likely to get trounced by forces both on the right and left. And also, we've got a weak leader in Germany as well. And Germany takes a very traditional pacifist stance on these matters. They've been very alarmed by what Macron has said. And so he's trying to sort of, you know, reinsert himself as the leader of Europe. And at the same time, we've got this contrast with Brigitte Macron giving interviews saying, you know, I'm very feminine because I wear miniskirts at the age of 70, and that makes me iconically French.
We'll come to Brigitte's knees in a moment, but let's just focus a little bit on the reasoning behind Macron's having his photograph taken. The photographer I mentioned is a woman called Soazig de la Moissonnière, and she is absolutely brilliant. She's very good at doing reportage of Macron, but these are clearly staged. And the immediate comparison was drawn between Macron being the tough guy, which is, and for all the reasons that you've just mentioned, Nina, but also Vladimir Putin quite likes to present himself as a super strong man, and he in the past has placed himself in sort of combative photographs. And was this a direct sort of hit, dare I say, towards Putin? Or what do you think drove him to do this, David?
Yeah, Macron is criticized a lot in France for being a gentle intellectual. He's a technocrat, he's wealthy, he's physically a tiny guy. So he's a gentle intellectual, where the far right is where real men live. And they're strong and they're tough and they don't mess around. There's a tradition of that. Mussolini would be photographed with a shirt off, Putin, people like that. What I find unusually preposterous about Mr. Macron, and I've been a boxing coach on and off for like decades. It's not only is it staged, that's fair enough, but he's posturing and it's pretend. He's never been in a boxing match in his life. He's standing next to a bag. Turns out bags don't fight back. The other one, if you...
Or it old is, bags, by that.
Old bags. The other thing is he's not a boxer. He's somebody of his size would have much thinner arms. You can look at middleweight boxers. So he's pumped himself up vainly in the gym. You only get like arms like that if you waste hours of a week from some sort of insecurity to like pump it up. You just stand there moving iron up and down. So he doesn't have the build of a boxer. His form is terrible, where his hands are. If I had a beginning student like that, I'd say, this is deadly for you. Do you want to get knocked out straight away? So he's pretending
to do this.
What's
he doing wrong?
He doesn't have his hands are protecting himself. He isn't turning
properly.
No,
they're down by the side, aren't they? They're by the side of his face. And, you know, having my boxer size classes from the deep and darkest passes, you cover your face because if you want to keep it pretty, that's how you do it.
Yeah. It's an odd thing to pretend to be. People who are actually boxers would never show off and be vain about it like that. People who are actually intellectuals don't have to tell you that they went to a top university. People who are... Usain Bolt never bragged about his the speed with which his legs could move forward along 100 meters.
But, I don't know, it sort of sparked a wonderful amount of coverage. I mean, the Evening Standard has actually got an article saying how to get the French leader's presidential-grade biceps. I mean, does one get the impression now that... I think he's not a great drinker. I think he wasn't drinking before he started. And then you talk about Rishi Sunak, who doesn't drink and he does his Peloton and all this kind of stuff. The modern leader, the modern efficient getting things done leader is an exercise fanatic as well, isn't he?
Partly, except there's something interesting that's happening in politics, and it's that we're seeing a lot of people step down in their mid-40s, about Emmanuel Macron's age. So we learnt this week that Leo Varadkar, the centre-right leader of Fine Gael in Ireland, is stepping down, aged only 45. Jacinda Ardern over from the other side of the political spectrum, but over in New Zealand, stepped down, aged 43. And then Nicola Sturgeon was only 53 when she stepped down for, you know, the situation that the S&P finds itself in being investigated at the moment. But still, we're seeing people stepping down from political office, even if they're fit, healthy, you know, and they're making a good show of trying to maintain, show that they are fit and healthy, as you were just saying before, whether it's Macron. You know, we're seeing sort of contradictory phenomena, aren't we? In the United States, we've got two very old white men running for office and nobody else on the ticket, really, to challenge them. Whereas over here in this part of the world, we've got these sort of young, vigorous, dynamic leaders keen to show how healthy and fit they are and how teetotal they are. But then when they get to their peak of their political career, they eventually say, I want to do something else because politics isn't what it was.
I wonder why that is, because if you look at Rishi Sunak here in the United Kingdom, he doesn't need to be a politician. He is a hyper-successful man in his own right. But David, tell us a little bit more about this decision. I mean, you've taught leadership, you've written books about how to lead without being a dreadful person. What is it that drives someone to get to the peak of their career and then, having hit it in your mid to late 40s, just think, actually, come on, I don't need this anymore? Is there a more glittering prize around the corner?
I think for some of these people, there is a deeper prize, maybe in personal fulfillment. For many of the others, though, it's sadly the speed of political change these days, social media and stuff. Some of these people who left in their 40s would have been delighted to stay on longer if they were more popular, if they weren't criticized for their decisions and had stayed in. Think of a generation or two ago, there was more leeway given to many political leaders, and the schedule of the turnaround and the attacks was slower.
And what kind of effect do you think that that will have on politics in the future? A question to you both, given the fact that I think we have seen a speeding up of turnaround in political advisors, of members of the civil servant, and this is certainly a British thing, but also perhaps I wonder across the rest of the world, when you go in young, ambitious, you move fast, which is great because you have the energy and the power. But something that I think a lot of us have noticed in the last 10 to 20 years is that you come in with all the energy, but you don't have the context. You don't have the knowledge. You don't have the history. If you look at Joe Biden, yes, energy levels are alarming. Longevity, doubtful. However, he's walked the walk. He's talked the talk. He's got everything. And so he can bring knowledge and wisdom to the party.
I think there's something different that happens in America, though, and I do notice this from the political landscape here, is you have this deference to a sort of political culture of a council of elders, don't you, David, which mm-hmm. you don't really have here. You know, remember, you know, all the times that you see, you know, people interviewing Bill Clinton 20 years after he's been out of office, and it's still Mr. President, whereas here in the United Kingdom, if it's Prime Minister on first reference and then afterwards Mr., you know, Mr. Sunak, Mr. this, Mr. that, we don't have the same culture in the UK of that sort of political deference and that recognition of the knowledge that you need to hold these big offices. Obviously, Trump is, you know, the disruptor to that in the United States. But I do think it's worrying because what we've seen is successively, in fact, my observation here is since covering David Cameron's first coalition government, is that we've seen shorter and shorter term political horizons, not just careers of politicians. We've got over 100 MPs, largely two-thirds of them from the Conservative Party in the UK, stepping down at this election. But the portfolios get changed around every 5 minutes. Excuse me, we've got, you know, briefs that haven't been finished, projects that haven't been finished. And that's fed all the way through to the civil service as well, as we've had this huge glut of hires to deal with Brexit and trade negotiations. And now, you know, the civil service itself has repeatedly found itself under attack and being beefed up and slimmed down. It just speaks to a lack of continuity that I think the electorate is getting increasingly exasperated with.
I wonder whether David Cameron is sort of an example, but also a contradiction in terms as well, that he is seen as, dare I say it, the elder statesman coming back as foreign secretary. Yet it is barely a decade since he left office.
For sure, and coming back unelected.
Coming back unelected, but also he came in young and he was the young hitter. And arguably what he did lacked the historical context and the wisdom that you require to steer the long-term prospects of a country, namely causing the Brexit referendum. And I remember when he was in power having commentators say, he's a great manager, he can deal with the next 2-3 months. But in terms of steering the ship, 10, 15, 20 years ahead. He's not got it. What are your thoughts on this sort of this shifting time frame?
I think that there's a deep trend and also a transitory trend, both of which apply. One of the deep trends is think what's happened to marriage. A while ago, people would get married and the books would tell them, you know what you got to do? You have to think about the marriage, possibly the kids also. Nowadays, people get married and you know what the books tell them? You have to think about your personal happiness. Is this person enhancing your personal happiness? So there's a shift from a group focus to an individual focus. And that's spread a lot through society. Think of all the ads where things are aimed specifically at you rather than for the group. So I think that's one part of it. It's a deep trend been going on for a generation or so. The other thing that locks it in and accelerates it is when we were speaking earlier about politicians jumping from one topic to another or having an office just for brief moments, think of what it's like with any of us with email. We sit around at home and we have one task and then we're pulled to another task and we're pulled to another task. Before email, you couldn't really do that. I mean, you could a little bit, but there was less pressure to do that. There were longer times in which you could respond to things. You might, it was physically harder to get entire documents from one field to another put to you. So our business world is encouraging transitory things and our social world is allowing transitory things. This notion of how you feel rather than what the purpose for your community is.
And do you think that will, those countries which do depend on a speed that you describe there, will suddenly find themselves in a very different place from the countries which have a much more, dare I say it, slow approach? For even for economic reasons, that, you know, the internet is not as widespread, that the technology is not as advanced.
In answer to that, I can think of William Goldman, the great Hollywood scriptwriter, got the Academy Award and stuff. He said, Hollywood, what does it do? It destroys your life. It takes your time, crushes your spirit. And what does it give you in exchange? A fortune. So sadly, the countries that are really fast and everybody's really unhappy tend to have a larger economy and more aircraft carriers.
Indeed, the Tages Anzeiger today, I think it was World Happiness Day or something. I'm no great fan of marking days, but this is an interesting one because it does make you step back. The Tages Anzeiger this morning is talking about not just the sort of like the is your soul happy? Are you happy within your marriage? Are you happy leading France or leading Russia? But how much money have you got? And it does become quite a bit, it becomes quite cold and hard and fast, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think, again, just going back to this idea of social media, again, everybody's trying to project happiness, wealth, health in the case of these leaders we were talking about on their Peloton bikes and, you know, avoiding, the odd tipple and so on and so forth. I think, you know, there's lots of different things that make you happy. And we are at risk, aren't we, here, particularly in places like the UK, of, you know, conflating wealth with, you know, this sort of fake image of life being perfect at all times. And if it isn't perfect at all times, then we automatically should be unhappy.
It isn't.
And then do something about it very quickly.
It's a baffling thing if you meet anyone who's around 2021 that so many people now live through their personal image online on Instagram, and they use filters and they use shades and whatever to make their faces look different. And yet some people who you talk to cannot understand that everybody is doing it. And so you get a generation of people who feel undermined by the fact that they're not as pretty as anybody else. So they put lots and lots of filters on what they look like, but do not grasp that everybody's doing it, so no one looks that way.
It's sort of like at a parade. If everybody's standing on their toes, you get really sore feet. If you simply made an agreement, guys, let's be honest, down with the toes. Simone Signoret was a beautiful French actress when she was young and was a dumpy old lady when she was old. And one of the other French actresses of her generation, Catherine Deneuve, who stayed very beautiful, working really hard as she got old, said, I admire Signoret for her honesty and her trust in herself.
So let's talk about aging beautiful French women. We've talked about young, sort of powerful, badly postured, punch bag punching French leaders. But Nini, you mentioned Brigitte Macron, who actually, before we came on air, we both agreed that we absolutely adore her because she's, well, she can do stuff that I can't, namely wear heels. So she wins there.
Yeah, and miniskirts same time, eh? You can have the heels and I'll have the miniskirts if you want. That can be our compromise. No, the I applaud Brigitte Macron for saying something. Look, full disclosure, we're all Francophiles who spend a lot of time, you know, living in France and imbued in French culture, so we're probably slightly biased as a panel here on this. But I applaud her for making this comment about saying, look, when you hit 35, you shouldn't give up your mini skirts. You know, if you feel comfortable wearing them, you know, French women shouldn't be fashion-wise as subject to ageism as they are in other parts of the world. And this makes me think of, you know, times in the United States where I spent a lot of time there when I was younger. You know, heaven forbid if it were a summer day and you went into the office without wearing tights or pantyhose, as they call it in the US. This was like a real taboo, right, in America. Over here in the UK, if you, you know, if you're over sort of 35, 40, you notice there's this sort of sartorial transformation towards floral dresses and cardigans, as you pointed out, David.
What is all that about?
I was once had dinner recently with a prominent politician who remarked that I could, quote, I'm quoting this person here, just like a 25-year-old, even though I was no longer 25. And this completely confused this person. And I just remember looking at them thinking, what are you talking about? And they said, well, you're not wearing a skirt below the knee for a start. I thought, you should meet Brigitte Macron, mate.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember even my mum saying after 35, you drop those hemlines. When did you drop your hemlines, David?
I try not to talk about it too much in public because I'm not secure in my male sexuality.
But you were talking about the issue of cardigans, weren't you, before
yes.
we came on air?
Yes, these are terrific signifiers. I can't remember, but a number of American actresses have said they go from being like the cute blonde who can't say anything but looks really, really cute and is the desire for men talk about her, to becoming suddenly, after a certain age, they wear cardigans. And then they become the working class housewife who's all wise and weary and stuff. But again, and then she can finally talk. So she's non-sexualized, a woman can talk. If she's sexualized, aside from Thelma and Louise and maybe about four others, she can't talk. People talk about her.
Yet there was an article in the Times this week that celebrated the return of the cardigan for men.
Yes. Now, this is scary. men who wear cardigans often are about to lift their right arm forward, waggle a finger, and explain things to you that you might not understand. There's a type of personality that does that. It's called alpha obnoxious. You meet many of them in a parliament, in the city, and I believe in certain households across the United Kingdom.
And do you believe in the power of the signifier of the cardigan, Nina? I think this is one of these, you know, one of those wildly underestimated pieces of clothing that seems to have some sort of socially totemic value now.
Let's face it, only certain people get away, pull off the cardigan look. And ironically enough, I think even though it's an item that covers you, you have to have a fit physique underneath it to actually make it look good. Otherwise, you know, button it.
Male clothes are often designed to hide the body because women's secondary sexual characteristics, sadly, often have to be put on display for everybody. Men's are power and the ability to take care of other people. So the business suit is very revealing. You can be a slob with a big fat stomach and wear a business suit. Imagine Mr. Trump dressed as Mrs. Macron, right? It wouldn't look...
No, thank you.
Pleasant.
You make a very good point there. You both make a very good point in terms of you talk about being physically fit. And this all goes back to the, are you fit for the job? You know, questions being raised about Donald Trump being fit enough, questions being raised about Joe Biden, questions not being raised about Emmanuel Macron because he's got his punch bag out. And clearly, you know, Brigitte Macron keeps in shape in order to be able to get into all these beautiful suits.
She does, but what's really crucial is that she and Emmanuel Macron don't have children. And she met Emmanuel Macron, he's 27 years her junior, after she'd had her children. So this idea of sort of, you know, tailoring her wardrobe towards her fertility window has never been an issue in their relationship. But I do think in some parts of the world, in the West, you know, this culture of, as I was saying before, how, you know, women should start dressing differently when they reach a respectable age of essentially that fertility window coming towards an end, marriage, kids, so on and so forth. And suddenly, you know, dressing differently and expected to be dressing differently. I do think it is a more Anglo-Saxon phenomenon than you see in France. In France, in Paris, you see people dressing amazingly well into their 40s, 50s and 60s, unashamedly so, if they've got the figures and feel comfortable to wear more revealing clothes, particularly in the south of France, you see it. And I applaud people like Brigitte Macron for talking about this. And, you know, she calls it iconically French, and I think it really is. But I'd like to see things changing here in the UK where people aren't, you know, judged so much and put in, as David was saying before, these sartorial pigeonholes just because they're in certain stages of their lives.
I think what you're describing might well happen in the UK and other countries. As sexism goes down, more women have real jobs after 35, 45 or whatever. And if you have a real job, there's something that is significant about you beyond the family. So as that spreads, it'll become more natural to be like Mrs. Macron in that respect.
This is all pinned down to a sense of self-respect, though. You know, look after your body, look after your appearance, sharpen up, step out. How many of us have been slightly frustrated by the number of sort of tracksuits that everybody's now wearing post-COVID?
Well, that's the youngsters.
Who could
actually pull a miniskirt off better, actually, ironically, I might argue.
Generational comfort now.
To some extent, so I mentioned earlier that I thought some of this stuff with the body is a more individualist culture. But there's another thing going on, which is we often do things which is a desire because we want the opposite. So we're surrounded by technology and machines. So young people, their lives are surrounded by machines. So you see in Shoreditch and in Brooklyn, people going around like really tough, looking really, really working on their bodies, both men and women. It's a desperate push against the machines. You were mentioning earlier, Emma, that many of the leaders in Europe are young. Europe's an old continent. They're worried about age. And these young people are a desperate attempt to be different. America is a continent where people are pulled apart by constant change and people moving all over. IBM used to be called, standing for I've been moved. So to have a council of elders, to fantasize that there's an equivalent of a wise House of Lords or a royal family is really desired.
Okay. The time here in London is 9:26. Let's head to France, where we can join Mary Fitzgerald, our North Africa correspondent, who happens to be in Paris. A very good morning to you, Mary. How's Paris looking this morning?
Paris is looking wonderful. We had a lot of rain yesterday, but a bit brighter today.
Okay. So glad to have you with us. We have a room full of Francophones, Francophiles. So bring us news from where you are.
Well, I've found the conversation about cardigans fascinating. I have to say, I'm team cardigan, but make it cashmere. But I do think, you know, picking up on something Nina said about the younger generation and that kind of comfort thing, I think similar dynamic here in France. The younger generation, it's all about yoga pants and trainers. There's definitely been a move away, I think, from more kind of formal dressing, or what's considered to be a kind of a stereotypical idea of how a French person, particularly French women, I think, dress. And that kind of ties in with a controversy in France over the past week, where there are reports that Macron would like the singer Aya Nakamura, who is a Black French singer of Malian heritage, to perform at the opening ceremony of the Olympics later this summer. And this has caused consternation and all these questions about, well, who really represents France, who should represent France, and all tied into notions of what it is to be French and what French people look like, which has been obviously quite a toxic conversation in many respects. So the far right are not happy about these reports that IMA represent France at the ceremony. So it's like the long-standing kind of culture war conversation here.
And it's astonishing, actually, that in 2024 there is such a scandal about a singer being black, not being seen as a symbol. I think Marine Le Pen said her presence is not a beautiful symbol. I mean, yes, we are dealing with a country which ties itself into the idea of Marianne and its national beauty, but how are we still having this conversation in 2024?
Well, I think it's the French. I think it's a more of a French conversation than, you know, I was discussing this with British friends who live in France over the past week, and they were basically saying it would be very unlikely to have this kind of conversation in Britain. It just happens to be a specific conversation here. And of course, it's charged politically, given the rise of the far right. So I consider it a very French conversation.
David, you've lived in France, you've written about France, but why? What's going wrong here?
A lot of people on the far right in France feel that they're not getting the respect that they want. Or they feel that there's a ladder or hierarchy in the in like the Tintin books or things like that. You can be nice to black people if they're really subservient and uneducated and they're below you. And many of the French colonists would be benevolent to their house servants. But in France, you get people who are computer programmers or great singers. England has many problems, but that's not one of the problems in Britain. Back in the 2012 Olympics, do you remember that beautiful song "Abide With Me" was sung by a singer? Nobody paid any attention to her skin color. She happens to be a black singer, I think, from Scotland. She sang beautifully, an a cappella, which is not bad in front of a billion people.
And indeed, in France, they physically pushed, in Paris, exactly, they physically pushed ethnic minorities out by creating the Bonnier in the 1950s and 60s.
Yeah, you didn't want to see it. It's a different attitude. And it's a shame because another part of France is terrifically inclusive. There are a number of young Arab men in the suburbs of Paris who are beautifully integrated into France and want nothing more than to be happily working in banks and software. I hung out with a lot of people like that. France has a tradition. At one point, the Archbishop of Paris was a Polish Jewish guy. This number two in the Communist Party was a Polish-Jewish guy, and one of the founders of ENA, the same thing. So France has taken talent from around the world. Think of all the exiles from Spain after Franco who were accepted. The parents might be a concierge, and then the children get fully accepted. So France can bring people in. I think if the hard right, if there is a shift in attitude or different leadership, it could disappear. At the moment, it's skillfully led to be angry.
I think this is a new phenomenon in comparison to what we've seen over the last 20 years, because I grew up with French culture where MC Solar was, you know, top of the charts, you know, and fated for singing in French, because at that time, 20, 25 years ago, you know, the presidents of France were increasingly concerned that France would lose its music. We also had the likes of Angélique Kidjo, who I think came from Benin, actually, not Senegal. But it was no big deal, these people topping the charts, particularly because in some cases they were francophone and they were actually singing in French, which was viewed as a positive thing. It's really sad now that we've come to a stage where obviously the far right, you know, is so much further in the polls. But at the same time, it's trying to make itself look more mainstream. So what's interesting is Marine Le Pen is she's moved way away from where her father was at the time when MC Solar was at the top of the charts. She's trying to make herself more mainstream, but she's still able to slip in these kind of pronouncements and captivate, you know, a certain audience.
Mary, how much is this a regional thing, given the fact that if you go to Paris, there is this wonderful explosion of different cultures, and it you know, Paris does feel quite cosmopolitan nowadays in a way that perhaps it didn't 2 days decades ago. And when you have someone like, I'm thinking of the chef Maurice Sacco, who's a Michelin starred chef, he has he's French, but his parents are from Mali, and he cooks a combination of Malian, Japanese and French food, and is fated as one of the most famous chefs on the television.
Indeed, there are a lot of paradoxes here, but picking up on something Nina mentioned about, you know, that this seems to be in some ways a regression. I had the exact same conversation the other day here in Paris with some French friends where we were talking about, everybody remembers the team that won the World Cup for France. I can't remember which year, but it was basically, this was a symbol of France and its glorious diversity, because you had black French players, you had French players of Arab background, etc. And that was a particular moment in France, and there was intense national pride over that team. And now, you know, there's the regression was basically the word that several people mentioned in terms of the current conversation. And also going back to Le Pen, you know, the fact that Le Pen now has been replaced as party leader by a 28-year-old, Jordan Bardella, who I was reading a piece during the week. He's a TikTok star, and he's basically hooking in young French to his political messaging through TikTok. So, you know, the far right is changing as well in terms of there's a generational shift. And one thing I find really interesting about the far right here in France is that, contrary to other trends in other European countries, one of the fastest growing demographics in terms of the support base for the far right here is the under 35s.
How much damage do you think that this will do to France's international standing, given the fact that this is, Mary, an Olympic year? This is the moment where everybody is looking to France to get it right.
Well, I think that this is the big question. You know, last year, France hosted the Rugby World Cup, and there was this extraordinary opening ceremony, extraordinary for all the wrong reasons, in that it was this tableau from the 1950s with a lot of cliches about village life in France. So there was Pierre with his striped shirt and his baguette. And, you know, everybody was white. And there was consternation. And one review in Libé, in Libération, was absolutely scathing, saying who scripted this this ceremony, because it's just so at odds with the reality of France today. So I think there's this push and pull conversation here. Again, that question of representation. What is France today? Who represents France, and who is the right, as some people would put it, to represent France?
Do you think France, this question to you, David, do you think France is able to poke fun of it, poke fun at itself in the way that perhaps other countries find it a little bit more easy to do? I mean, I'm just thinking of actually the Air France safety video, which has a gentle rib at all the French clichés that you could possibly imagine while they tell you how to, you know, buckle up and, you know where the exits and the entrances are. And for the first time, you suddenly got this feeling that they were finding it a little bit funny, and they were able to find it quite
totally
a bit of a joke.
There's a great tradition in France of mockery, not just with Voltaire, but people before him and people after him and stuff. Humor, self-teasing. There was one person who came from North Africa after France left North Africa, said, "Ah, my family always talks about Algeria. That's when we had nothing, nothing, nothing." So they can tease all the laments about it. On the other hand, you can usually tease and make jokes when you come from a position of confidence. A generation ago, or two generations ago, France could be really pleased with its black hip-hop stars because, again, kind of like in the Tintin books, they were a subservient people who were really, really nice. Look, they're trying to imitate our language. If you have a feeling of confidence on top, you can be very happy with the youngsters below. Sadly, I don't think the reality is so much, but Le Pen and people like that have encouraged this feeling that Arab people and black people around the world are not just in a polite position down there, but are a big threat coming to a village near you.
Mary, how confident is France feeling at the moment, given the fact that, you know, it's doing pretty well economically, it's leading very well internationally? Emmanuel Macron is going out there, boxing gloves on, to try and, you know, take control of the European agenda, trying to lead the way with Ukraine. Also, culturally, there is an enormous amount of investment into France at the moment, and even to the point where they help you to pay for mending your own clothes. Externally, if you look outside, it looks like France is doing pretty well.
Indeed, but, you know, it's one of the eternal French paradoxes, the fact that, you know, the French are never really happy with their lot. You know, the research repeatedly shows that the French record some of the highest levels of unhappiness in Europe in particular. So there's that paradox in terms of, you know, the rest of the world is sold this idea of the French way of life as something to aspire to. Meanwhile, at home, the French are not very happy.
So tell us a little bit more about, there's a story breaking that I think that you and Nina want to talk about, is that they're so unhappy, they've stopped drinking wine.
Yes, indeed. So this is fascinating. And I was discussing this with a Portuguese wine producer over dinner last night, talking about how the French seem to be falling out of love with wine. In a recent piece in Le Monde, it highlighted the fact that for the second year in a row, the French say they prefer beer to wine, and wine consumption more generally is falling across France, particularly amongst younger people. And this is a trend that we're seeing. You know, the Portuguese woman at dinner last night was saying something similar in Portugal, elsewhere in Europe, also in the US. People are simply drinking less alcohol more generally, but wine in particular seems to be suffering from a bit of an image problem amongst the young.
And I mean, have you noticed this when you're out and about in Paris, that people, I mean, when I go to Paris, I haven't seen any marked and angry refusal of a small glass of red over dinner, or indeed a second one. But is this something that people are actually feeling and picking up on?
Definitely. So the phenomenon of dry January has become quite a thing in France. When it started a few years ago, it was the subject of some ridicule, but it has definitely become a thing. And I noticed as well, there's a whole, you know, sobriety movement. So in Marseille, for example, we have Laura Vidal, who was awarded Sommelier of the Year a couple of years ago. She's now known as the Sober Somme. She has embraced sobriety and she continues her work, but she uses a spittoon. So she has been talking about, and here in Paris, there are a number of shops that specialize in non-alcoholic wine. So it's definitely becoming a thing.
This is something that you wanted to pick up as well, something that's happening in Bordeaux, that they're now trying to make non-alcoholic Bordeaux, which is making my little head spin.
Impossible, doesn't it? But apparently you can market it, if you get it right, for about €55 a bottle, maybe even more, according to this article and the Times of London here, which has interviewed a number of sort of high-level Bordeaux producers who are increasingly catering to a Middle Eastern market in particular that is commissioning them to making really good Bordeaux that, you know, have the alcohol essentially evaporated from them. It's harder, it seems, to make red wine taste good without alcohol than sort of sparkling white and rosé vintages. And also the other issue is that it's quite hard to make sure that these wines keep if they don't have the alcohol content to actually neutralise any sort of nasty bugs that could grow in them. But it is a much bigger market. And of course, France is suffering a big wine glut this year where they're having to spend a lot of money to try and, as they usually do, you know, tailor the market to dwindling demand and excess supply.
Mary, when you're going to around your French supermarkets, when you're popping into Monoprix for a pat of butter or whatever, have you noticed a rise in the amount of non-alcoholic wine on the shelves?
Not so much non-alcoholic wine in supermarkets, but definitely things like there's a big kombucha trend here and non-alcoholic drinks. When I host gatherings at my place in Marseille, I realize, and this has been the case for the last couple of years, I do need to organize the non-alcoholic drinks because there will be several people coming who said that they're not drinking alcohol in that particular night or they've cut their consumption.
Mary Fitzgerald in Paris, thank you so much for bringing us that. You're listening to Monocle on Sunday with me, Emma Nelson. The time here in London is 9:41. And we're going to head to Austria now to hear from our correspondent in Vienna, Alexei Korolev. A very good morning to you. Grüß Gott.
Morning, Emma.
How's life in Vienna this morning?
All good, all good. It's, you know, it's sunny. It's very nice. We had 20 degrees yesterday. Today it's down to 10, but, you know, still looking nice.
It's probably, I could cope with that in Vienna. I'm sure I could. Tell us what's happening where you are.
Well, you know, of course, the big news today is the election across the border in Slovakia that has delivered a bit of a surprise in that a pro-Western candidate is now leading. So basically won the first round of the presidential election that is now heading to a second round in 2 weeks' time, I think, 6th of April. And that was a bit of a surprise because a very sort of pro-government candidate was considered to be the front runner, Peter Pellegrini. But he's now in second place. And as I say, it was a bit of a shock to me as well. You know, I went to bed last night fully confident that I was going to wake up to the news of Peter Pellegrini leading the vote. But that's not what happened. So it is a surprise. But, you know, in another sense, it isn't a surprise, really, because it sort of follows a pattern that we saw in previous Slovak presidential elections, where basically you had a bunch of candidates running on a pro-government or even nationalist right-wing platform pitted against a single liberal pro-Western candidate. And in the last two elections, it was the pro-Western candidates that won. So in 2014, it was a guy called Andrei Kiska, the entrepreneur who is also the man behind a flying car project in Bratislava.
Just tell us a little bit more of the context of this. This is the presidential elections this year, which doesn't have clearly the influence of the rest of Slovakia's politics, which has changed phenomenally in the last few months. I mean, up until a few months ago, Slovakia was, you know, happily embedded in the European NATO project, and then it's veered really strongly towards the politics of Viktor Orban and has become one of the most pro-Russian countries in Europe, hasn't it?
That's completely right, yes. So in September, Slovakia had a general election that delivered Robert Fico, former three-time prime minister, so now he's in his fourth time in office, who is very pro-Russian. He's friends with Viktor Orban. You know, he famously said in the run-up to the election, that election in September, you know, no, not a single bullet for Ukraine if he got the job. And that's indeed what happened. So once he got elected, he formed a coalition with a breakaway party from his party and another nationalist party. And that's the first thing they did. They halted state military aid to Ukraine. And, you know, he's a very divisive figure. So this presidential election obviously is seen as a sort of referendum on whether or not Slovaks accept his policies. And of course, you know, the question of Ukraine is the one that's been dominating Slovak politics now for the past few months. But that's not the only thing. So Robert Fico, of course, you know, he refuses to speak to liberal journalists, for example. So he's only speaking to state media or to sort of the journalists that he likes. He wants to sort of remake Slovakia's national broadcaster and to basically appoint political appointees to the top jobs there, and so on. And, you know, and all of this has angered Slovaks very much and has sort of galvanized them into action. So there's been lots of protests across the country in the past few months in protest at what Robert Fico is doing. So, of course, Slovaks were very, so, you know, this was the main issue in this presidential election, you know, whether or not they'll get a candidate, they'll get a president who supports this sort of politics or not. And, you know, the way things have panned out so far, they've plumped for a pro-Western approach, at least in the presidential office.
Let's move to the country that you're in, Austria, but head a little bit west towards Salzburg. Salzburg, not necessarily a city when the numerous times that I visited would strike me as being particularly communist. In fact, one would possibly argue it's in exactly the opposite direction. But it looks like they're going to get a communist mayor. What's happening?
Well, yeah, that is really one of the big mysteries of Austrian politics the past few years. So in 2021, Graz, the second biggest city in Austria, got a communist mayor, a very lovely woman, Elke Kahr. I met her and I profiled her for The Urbanist, one of our shows here on Monocle Radio. Now the same thing basically is happening in Salzburg. And it's because the Communist Party of Austria, which, by the way, is the third oldest communist party in the world and the oldest continuously operating political party in Austria, it has enormous appeal on the local level. So, you know, talking about rising cost of living, talking about affordable housing, those are the core issues that the other parties couldn't deliver on. But they're really doing some very nice stuff with it, you know. And so the guy in Salzburg who is likely to become mayor, very nice guy with a wonderful Austrian name, Kai Michael Dunkel, he, of course, you know, he's been focusing on affordable housing, but he also promised in the same way that that other communist mayor in Graz did, that, you know, he's going to give away most of his salary to the needy, to the poor. And that also appealed quite a lot to the Austrians. So right now he is sort of neck and neck with a social democrat. But that social democrat is, you know, a bit of a faceless bureaucrat. And Kai Michael Dunkel, the communist candidate, is a very, very charismatic figure. And as I say, he's very likely to win. And Austria will get a second communist mayor.
Astonishing stuff. Finally, another rather astonishing a story which delightfully you sent me a link to, and it's from Pferde Review, the horse review newspaper of Austria, a fabulous publication which I shall spend extensive time having a look at later. But there's the scandal of the plastic shoes of the Viennese horses. What's gone wrong?
Well, yes. Yeah, so, Emma, as a frequent visitor to Vienna, I mean, I'm sure you're aware of the Fiaker, those horse-drawn carriages that are very much a symbol of old Austria, of old Vienna, you know, part of its charm and touristic appeal. And, you know, for years, these carriages, the horses, have been a source of controversy, basically because, you know, animal rights groups are saying, you know, cities, especially a city like Vienna, you know, is not the right environment for an animal like a horse, which is a flight animal, you know, cities full of cars and strange sounds and so on. And of course, horses, while they clop along, you know, they damage the streets. So now this recent, and yeah, so there have been lots of suggestions, including from the government, that they should actually be banned outright. So in 2022, I think, the health minister of Austria, no less, suggested that they should be banned altogether. And that caused a huge, huge scandal. But this recent development is a sort of a compromise from the city of Vienna, who suggested that the horses should wear plastic shoes in order not to damage the streets so much, and, you know, lessen the noise and pollution and so on. Well, I'm very curious if that's actually going to happen. So the government, the city government of Vienna, has made available almost 2 million euros towards this purpose. And the Fiaker companies, the horse, the carriages, carriage companies, they can apply for this funding and basically just buy the shoes and reshoe their horses. But I really am very curious to see if that's actually going to happen, because, of course, you know, some of these companies have already said, you know, that's going to destroy, that's going to rid Vienna of this very characteristic and very lovely sound of you know, horses galloping on the streets. So, you know, I don't know if it's going to happen. If it happens, I'm sure it's going to be good for the city.
I'm sure it will. Alexei Korolev in Vienna, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle on Sunday. I'm joined still in the studio by David Badonis and Nina Dos Santos. Anyone here wearing plastic shoes?
Of course, my Supergas.
There we go. You got plastic shoes, and how about you?
I have my famous trainers, which last until they stop lasting, at which point I go into a store and say, give me the exact same things. Each year I try to shop for less than 60 minutes. This year I've used up 23 minutes already.
Okay. That's such a strange answer. but if you were... All right, place yourself in the position of a Fiaker horse.
Okay.
If someone says... No more of those traditional, wonderful horseshoes. It's plastic all the way. I mean, one wonders what the sort of like the union rights of the average Viennese horse could be.
Goodness me, it's a good thing that they don't go to the balls and waltz at this rate, isn't it?
Right. It's a shocker. I can't believe that the Viennese have thought about putting plastic shoes on their horses, given the fact that, look, dare I say it, Austria does its best to modernise, but when you are wandering around the centre of Vienna, as Alexei said, you have horses and they make the horse noise, and that's what makes Vienna so wonderful.
I suppose they could develop the high-tech industry and put little internet-enabled devices in the plastic that will generate in the earphones of everybody walking by, given that when you pass passport control, the traditional clip-clap sound, kind of like we call it the Disneyfication of the world. In Disney World, outside of there, there's ponds in Florida which look beautiful and blue. Ponds in Florida aren't. They're full of mud. Disney scrapes out the ponds, puts white cement in, paints it blue, and then puts fresh water back in that's filtered. If this happens in Vienna, it'll be a similar effect. All these beautiful, authentic things won't be there.
In the same way that they painted the grass green when Bill Clinton came to Birmingham.
I didn't know that.
They did.
Oh, I love it.
They did.
Which is perhaps appropriate, because Bill Clinton has tried to paint his own past.
But he's younger than Biden and Trump.
Isn't that incredible?
Isn't that incredible?
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah, it's amazing. But that idea of sort of creating something out of nothing, it reminds me of there's a big argument about whether they should put the sound of a car in an electric car so that no one gets run over.
Well, and I think it is concerning. I've got two young children who are 8 and 6, and I live in a really, really urban part of London. And I grew up in this part of London, which is also very urban. And I remember as a young child, you could hear the cars coming in this area. And, you know, my mother would, you know, scream, stop. And my twin sister and I would stop at the end of a zebra crossing. And we'd know we'd stop because we'd hear a car. And now I'm really concerned that, you know, cars can't, they might not be able to see my kids because they're often 4x4s and much bigger. And my kids can't hear them either. So I do think it is a bit of a concern. And that's for young children. Imagine what it's like if you're blind or you have a disability. You know, in some way you're sort of impaired in terms of your mobility. I do think that, you know, we have to be careful with cars, you know, particularly on zebra crossings and stuff like that, when you can't hear them.
Let's pick up on something that actually is only... peculiar to us three, which is you mentioned Voltaire.
Yes.
A little earlier on. Are we right in thinking that all our favourite books are Voltaire's Candide? That is my favourite book.
Indeed.
And yours?
I, well,
you,
I like...
You,
You've written about Voltaire.
Yes, I like Candide very much, but as we were discussing earlier, he wrote it out of terrible bitter sadness. The love of his life had died a little bit earlier, and when people said to him, oh, it's all for God's good plan and stuff, he was furious. How could you say that? It's like somebody with cancer being told, oh, it's part of a plan.
So this is a book that was written in the 18th century by the philosopher, well, I don't know if it was, yes, he was a philosopher, he was in everything, the polymath Voltaire, and it is the story of Candide, who believes that he lives in the best of all possible worlds. And then it is the ultimate journalist's book, isn't it? Because it is written, there is disaster followed by disaster followed by disaster, written at 100 miles an hour. It is a blisteringly fast read. It's a blisteringly easy read. And it is full of life and energy. And it's a strange thing that we're using Monocle on Sunday to have a sort of an 18th century book review slot this morning.
Of a book that's been reviewed ad infinitum, I should say. But you're right, actually, because for those of us who are journalists, you know, I spent 13 years at CNN and other years at other big networks like NBC, Sky News and so on and so forth. And the Viewer as well. We are constantly bludgeoned with bad news, you know, and bad news that appears to be so much out of our control. And this is what Voltaire's Candide is all about. It's about a young man who naively thinks when he's young that lots of elements in life are within his grasp. He falls in love with his boss's daughter and then he's forbidden from marrying her. He follows her around the world, you know, through all these difficult, terrible events. You know, he sees slavery in South America. He, you know, at one point gets into bed with religious factions that, you know, are persecuted. And he ends up, I think, in Constantinople, doesn't he, in Istanbul. It's extremely international. And yet again, throughout the course of this book, there's all these hard life lessons that are still current today that are being taught to Candide, this sort of naive young man. And he still thinks that things must be better and will eventually get better than they are. And you were just talking, David, about how one of his inspirations was, Voltaire's inspiration was losing the love of his life. It was also the Lisbon earthquake,
yes,
wasn't it?
Yes, very much.
Which, you know, it raised his faith in God, because he was essentially saying, you know, if things can be this bad, what kind of God is there if that many people can be killed in a natural disaster?
So the one of the key things is this, is the idea of that Candide is a gentle character. He is, and I think they say it right at the beginning, he was born in Westphalia and he had this amazing gentle character, and yet he has to go through dreadful, dreadful disasters, which, as Nina has just laid out, but phenomenally Voltaire makes it all incredibly funny. But he has to do some dreadful things. He has to kill lots of people. He has to be absolutely brutal. And there's that idea that you can be gentle, but sometimes you have to do dreadful things, or you have to do very, very strong things. And it sort of takes us all the way back to the beginning of the programme, doesn't it? Where we have Emmanuel Macron. Is he a gentle intellectual president, or is he a little bit of a punchbag thumper?
That polarity is there all the time. You mentioned, Nina, about the Lisbon earthquake is absolutely spot on. If there's any group that Voltaire disliked, it was the established religion of his time. And that after a terrible earthquake, people would say it's God's will. He didn't like that a little bit on theological and moral grounds, but also because it made people think, you know what? If that's God's will, everything is, including social improvement. Voltaire's subtext in that book was, do not be passive before the people say, this is the way the world is, we can never change it. Work constantly to make incremental small change.
Nina Dos Santos and David Badanis, thank you so much for joining me in the studio. And the warmest of thanks to all my guests, Mary Fitzgerald and Alexei Korolev, for joining us on the line today. The programme was produced and studio managed by Mariella Bevan. I'm Emma Nelson. Monocle on Sunday returns next week. But until then, enjoy the rest of your weekend. And Voltaire's Candide is out now.